From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, the presidential campaign through the eyes of a former candidate. We'll talk with Paul Tsongas about some of the things he learned while campaigning in the Democratic primaries, and we'll ask him to critique the campaign process. Also, film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Batman Returns, starring Michael Keaton, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Danny DeVito. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger pleaded not guilty today to charges that he lied to Congress and to federal prosecutors about the Iran-Contra affair. NPR's Nina Totenberg reports.
The 74-year-old Weinberger, who now serves as publisher of Forbes magazine, appeared in federal district court here in Washington for a formal arraignment. His lawyer, Robert Bennett, asked for a quick trial date, saying, "This is a tremendous cloud over him. He's a public figure. His livelihood depends on his maintaining his reputation." Judge Thomas Hogan set the trial to begin November 2nd, acknowledging that the date is, quote, "optimistic," but adding, "We will attempt to keep it." The date, just one day before the election, raises the possibility that pretrial maneuvering could create political embarrassment for President Bush, who, as vice president, attended some of the meetings at issue in the case against Weinberger. It is Weinberger's notes of those meetings and his failure to disclose the existence of the notes that are the basis for the indictment against him. I'm Nina Totenberg in Washington.
Irish voters have renewed optimism about the Treaty on European Unity by voting overwhelmingly to ratify the agreement in yesterday's referendum. The treaty's designed to coordinate European community policy on defense and foreign affairs and create a common currency for the 12 member nations. Prospects for the union dimmed earlier this month when Danish voters narrowly rejected it. Irish leaders campaigned hard for approval of the treaty, which was opposed by some Irish nationalists and activists on both sides of the abortion rights question. In New Jersey, authorities have made two arrests in the case of a missing Exxon executive, but the executive is still missing. Steve Inskeep reports.
After following a trail of ransom notes and cellular phone calls to Georgia and back to New Jersey, authorities have arrested former Exxon security guard Arthur Seal and his wife Irene. They're charged with kidnapping and extortion. FBI agents say they made the arrest in Morris County when the Seals tried to pick up ransom money. But Morris County Prosecutor Michael Murphy says Exxon International President Sidney Riso is still missing.
6 weeks ago, I addressed you as a group and announced that our goal was to secure the safe return of Sidney Riso, president of Exxon Company International. That primary goal has not yet been achieved.
A special task force continues the search for Riso. The SEALs appeared calm and confident when they appeared before a federal judge today, but they could face life in prison. For National Public Radio, I'm Steve Inskeep in New Jersey.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street, recovering slightly from a broad decline over the past week and a half. Today was a quarterly triple witching hour when stock index futures and options expire, but analysts said the market showed no disruptive effects. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 11 points to close at 3,285. Advances led declines by about 10 to 7. This is NPR News. A Russian nuclear expert said today that small quantities of nuclear material that have appeared recently on the black market appear to be coming from civilian sources in the former Eastern Bloc. Austrian police have uncovered two cases in which smugglers allegedly tried to sell uranium pellets, apparently destined for Arab countries. Experts disagree as to whether the material came from Kazakhstan, Romania, or Czechoslovakia. A Russian scientist said today that security was tight at military facilities, but more lax at civilian nuclear power plants. Authorities are concerned that larger quantities of weapons-grade nuclear material may reach the black market in the future. A Supreme Court ruling handed down today could have a big impact on the amount of state income tax some interstate businesses pay. Beth Graham of member station WUWM reports.
The company that makes Wrigley chewing gum owes the state of Wisconsin income tax on gum sales, according to today's Supreme Court decision. A federal law bars states from taxing the income of an out-of-state company that simply solicits sales within its borders and then ships goods from another state. But the Supreme Court says that law doesn't apply to the William Wrigley Jr. Company of Illinois because its business involvements in Wisconsin are more extensive. That business including renting storage space, maintaining product displays, and replacing stale gum in stores. For National Public Radio, I'm Beth Graham in Milwaukee.
Georgian President Edward Shevardnadze charged today that Russian forces are helping separatists in Georgia who want to unite with their ethnic neighbors in Russia. The area in dispute is called South Ossetia, an ethnic enclave within Georgia's borders. Hundreds of people have been killed in fighting between the Ossetians and Georgian nationalists. Shevardnadze said today that helicopters with Russian Air Force markings have attacked towns and Georgian National Guard positions. This is NPR News.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. A lot of voters have become disenchanted with the presidential campaign process, but what is it like to be one of the candidates? My guest is Paul Tsongas, who was a Democratic presidential contender until he suspended his campaign in March. As you probably remember, he won the New Hampshire primary. Tsongas is the former senator from Massachusetts. In 1984, he decided not to run for re-election after he was diagnosed as having cancer, a kind of lymphoma which was considered incurable. But he had experimental therapy, which seems to have led to his recovery. He wrote a book about getting cancer and leaving the Senate called Heading Home. A new edition has just been published in paperback. I spoke with Paul Tsongas earlier today from Boston and asked him what it's like to be a spectator of the presidential campaign after having been a contender.
Well, I guess in some respects it's almost a good news, bad news kind of situation. Good news in the sense that one gets to see one's family. A lot of the financial drain of the campaign stops. Physically, obviously, it's a lot easier life. I competed three weeks ago in the National Masters Swimming Championship, so I was able to train for that. And that was very important because it enabled me to do something and focus on something that was totally physical and in which there really is not a heck of a lot of mental preparation. And I must say that was very therapeutic.
Do you plan on running for any office again?
The only office that I would run for again would be the presidency. I would have no interest in any other. And that would all depend on what happens in this election. If Bill Clinton wins or if Ross Perot wins and does well, there's no rationale. I don't ache to be president. There would have to be some rationale, some purpose to it. And we'll see what happens.
Do you still think of yourself as a player in the party?
Oh, I think I'm a player in the party, and almost in a sense of a kind of default, that the book that we wrote, the small one, The Call to Economic Arms, there have been something like 250,000 copies of that which have been printed. And I think as a intellectual base for the Democratic Party, that's where this party has to go if it seeks to win the White House and be relevant to the problems of this country. So in that respect, I think there really has been impact. And I think if you look at the votes that I received after I got out of this race, that message survives.
I'd like to get your critique of campaigning, having just gone through a great deal of it. What did you find to be the most ridiculous aspect of the way presidential campaigns are run now?
Well, let me count the ways. a lot of, in terms of what you look back on and see as rather absurd, one is simply the pace. This notion that you have to be some kind of, what is the name of that battery they advertise on television, the Energizer?
The bunny.
Right, and that somehow that substitutes for thought, it substitutes for courage or positions. And the fact is that the press is partly responsible. I remember during our campaign, we tried to be reasonable on the schedule, and because of the issue of my having had cancer in the past, that some of the press reports began to question my stamina. Well, obviously, you can't run for president for a year and train for swimming at the same time and have a stamina problem, but the notion was that unless you are on the go 18 hours a day, every day, continuously, that somehow you didn't have the stamina to be president. And I found that rather absurd. The other part of it, frankly, is the question of having some access and control of what's happening within your various organizations around the country. And that's all very technical and rather hard to explain. But to run a campaign in 50 states at a time of limited resources is very, very difficult. And what happens is that the candidate ends up having that prey on his or her mind rather than being focused on the issues.
Oh, you mean that your time's taken up by the organization?
Well, you're worried about, for example, after the New Hampshire primary, which we won, we felt compelled to hire our own plane, a 727, and the expense of that was just staggering. And the sense of, well, can we afford this? Those kinds of worries really begin to get in the way of a thoughtful view of the issues. So it's like any other enterprise that you're trying to figure out a strategy, yet you're spending all your time worrying about bookkeeping and those kinds of things.
How much of your campaign time did you have to spend fundraising?
Well, that's interesting because most people presume that the vast majority of my time was spent doing that. That was not true. And the reason was that nobody would do a fundraiser. The fact is that in the beginning, when the press dismissed my candidacy, we raised in 1991 only $1 million. To give you some perspective, Michael Dukakis, in the same time period, 4 years earlier, raised $10 million. So we simply did not have a lot of people around the country who were willing to do fundraisers. Where we began to do well financially was after, just before the New Hampshire primary, when we went ahead in the polls. And the money raising at that point was simply average people around the country sending money in. So I never had the traditional sort of New York, Wall Street, Beverly Hills fundraisers, because no one thought I was viable politically and therefore did not do that. But the money that kept us going, we raised $1.4 million in February, $1.4 million in March, with just average people who we had never met simply sending the money in unsolicited for the most part.
What did you think of Jerry Brown's use of the 800 number?
If I have one regret, there's more than one, but when he did that, and we all considered it to be foolish and absurd, it in fact was brilliant. What he did was he gave people an opportunity to contribute and just provided them a channel. And if there was one thing I would go back and do differently is that I would have beat him to that punch, especially since my last name has seven letters and would lend itself to the 800 number.
There you go. What else would you have done differently?
I think the major concern we had really focused on money. And I think we should have budgeted differently. It's really the kind of the mechanics. And also, I think there was a period of time when the message got lost in wondering what to do about being attacked in other people's ads. And I think we sort of got off course at that point. And by the time we got back on, it was a bit too late.
Mm-hmm. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Tsongas. And I should mention there's a new edition of his book, Heading Home, which is a book about his cancer and putting that behind him. You know, it's interesting. After you dropped out of the race, it seemed like the campaign completely changed. I don't mean it changed because you dropped out of the race, but it's like a completely different campaign now than it was when you were in it.
Well, it seems that way. It's interesting. When you don't really notice things while you're in the middle of them, but it's only when you get out that there's really a perspective on what has happened. And I think part of what is going on at this point is that there really is a kind of search, to quote the president, for the vision thing in both parties. And in the absence of a clear articulation of vision by either party, you then have the Ross Perot phenomenon.
What do you think Ross Perot's success so far should be saying to the Democratic Party, to your party?
Well, if I... It seems so self-evident that it's almost absurd to have to articulate it week after week and get no response. But the fact is that Ross Perot is doing well because he's not one of the other two. And what people are saying to the Democratic Party basically is give us a vision, a sense of direction that would give us comfort that you know how to run this economy. And the fact is, if you look at the discussions going on now over the Democratic platform, everything is incremental. There's discussion in the paper today about dropping the middle class tax cut, which I campaigned against, and substituting a children's tax credit. Well, the point is still the same. You're massively in debt. You've got to take your money, invest it so this country's economy comes back, and yet the Democrats are still focused on how do we give things away. And that's why there is such discomfort on the notion of the Democrats being in power. And I would hope that all the fuss we're going to make at the convention on the platform, we're going to present what we call a hard choices plank at the platform, at the convention. It's going to involve things like the deficit, entitlements, those kinds of things, investment strategies, and once and for all determine whether the Democratic Party is capable of understanding how severe the economic crisis is and what is going to have to take place in order to give the next generation some hope of a viable economic life.
Perot is using his own money to finance his campaign, and he says he's willing to spend about $100 million. Do you think it's a good thing or a bad thing for American politics to have someone investing that much personal money in a campaign?
Well, the notion that you can be a viable candidate for president because you have deep pockets, I suppose, is theoretically troubling. Someone asked me the other day, if I ran again in 1996, how would I ensure that I would have the funds? And my response was that between now and then, I'm going to ask Ross Perot to adopt me so that that would be taken care of. It is rather intriguing that here I am trying to struggle to pay off a debt of about $250,000, and you have someone who has not really articulated ideas in any great detail. I don't mean that as negative as it just sounded, but it was a very serious candidate because of his own personal wealth. Now, we have had people who ran for president, FDR, JFK, etc., who were very wealthy and did very well. So I'm not as troubled by it in practice as I am in theory, so I don't really spend much time worrying about it.
You had called yourself, when you were campaigning, the most electable Democrat. Bill Clinton is running third in the Gallup polls now, you know, behind Perot, who's first, Bush, who's second. Do you think Clinton is electable?
I think yes. Let me tell you what I think is happening. If you think of it in terms of the focus of the nation, that you had the nation focused on George Bush during the Persian Gulf in the period after that. He chose not to use his popularity in order to face the domestic problems of this country, as we all know. So what happened was that when people began to realize that we were not just in a business cycle downturn, but were in fact in a process of long-term economic decline, they then focused on we Democrats. And we went through the our process. And then this notion, well, maybe the Democrats are stuck in their old ideologies and bromides. Then you had a vacuum that was created. Then the focus now shifted over to Ross Perot, and that's where it is at this point. So if Ross Perot were to implode, then I think the process will be, it'll go back to the Democrats, a second look at Bill Clinton. And that's the point where the Democratic platform would kick in, that he would be able to adhere to a platform that's somewhat different in terms of things like the middle-class tax cut, being against it, against the Seawolf submarine, for certain investment strategies. He could then hold those people. If he doesn't, then the focus will return to its original base, i.e. the president, and he'll get elected. So it's a very fluid situation. The only person who really has control over his destiny at this point is Ross Perot. And a few more comments like you did on appointing a gay to the cabinet, I think would be very troublesome.
One of the ways in which the campaign has changed since you dropped out is the way the media is being used, you know, with all the candidates now going on the talk shows, Bill Clinton doing a town meeting on MTV. President Bush today said that he'd never do something like MTV. Let's see, I've got the quote here. He says, "You've got to draw the line somewhere, and I'm not going to be out there being a kind of teeny bopper at 68. I just can't do it." Would you have done it?
I would have done it. I think, I must say, I have a certain pang of identification with the president's statement. I have three daughters, and the oldest is 18, the youngest is about to be 11, so I find myself in their conversations wondering which world we're living in terms of my understanding what they are talking about. But the fact is that MTV and the others have audiences. Those audiences are part of this country. And it may be difficult. I think you can go on MTV and have some dignity. The notion that the format determines the dignity of the person, I just think is a rather absurd statement.
Paul Tsongas is my guest. We're going to take a short break, then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Paul Tsongas, and I should mention there's a new edition of his book, Hitting Home. Tell me why you wanted to be president. I think it's actually difficult for a lot of people to understand why someone would want to be president. Yes, there's the kind of power of it and everything, but there's so many headaches involved with the office, and there are so many seemingly unsolvable problems that are laid at the president's feet. Why did you want the job? And I mean, you've been in politics long enough to know about the kind of frustrations that you have campaigning for such a job.
Well, I guess now that I'm not a candidate, hopefully my comments would have more credibility. But I said during the campaign that I felt an obligation of my survival. When I left Washington in 1984, I never thought that I would come back into politics at any level, let alone run for president. But I've been out in the private side. I see what's happening to this country in terms of its economy. I know what the implications of that are long term. And so I felt strongly that I knew where we had to go. I wrote the book, A Call to Economic Arms. And my thought at that point was to do a book tour, to endorse somebody else, run in New Hampshire, or run across the country. So that's where it came from. If you remember, when I got into this thing, or did back last March, April, a year ago, George Bush was at 91%. I was dismissed as a serious candidate. It was Greek. I was from Massachusetts. I've had cancer. I have no office, etc. But I believe passionately in the ideas and strategies that were in my book. And my feeling was, as my wife said, that we have an obligation to the world our children are going to live in. And we felt that very strongly. So when I announced my candidacy, I had never lost an election, and I was very proud of what I had done. And I knew damn well that when I got into this thing that there would be a level of ridicule. But it didn't bother me because I felt that for whatever reason, that I had survived my cancer and that I felt that obligation. And therefore, the running, in essence, this sense of obligation insulated me from worrying about what people thought. And I think, obviously, I've changed the debate in the Democratic Party, and I feel fulfilled.
Do you feel that you succumbed to any campaigning pressures and ended up doing things that you didn't really want to do, but you knew you had to do to stay viable?
I guess the one thing that I have a sense that I gave into was a schedule that was inhuman. The fact is that we were so concerned about the media's focus on my stamina, which was a nonsense issue, but they were so focused on it, that we simply ran a schedule that would pour me into the streets and engage in activity at a pace that was simply not sustainable, particularly someone like me who has a need for 8 hours sleep a night. You're running on 5-6 hours, and eventually you pay a price for that. I remember during the end, I would be giving speeches, and would almost wake up in the middle of them. I'm not sure my audience did, but to give you a metaphor, analogy, everyone's driven down a highway and your mind kind of slips into other thinking, you sort of snap 2 or 3 miles down the road and wonder how you got there. Well, that was happening to me during the campaign. I'd be in the middle of a speech and sort of wake up 10 minutes later in the speech and wonder, God, I hope I stuck to what I was supposed to talk about. And that was a function of being tired, and we gave in. we gave in to the pressure to have that kind of a schedule, and if I ever do it again, I would not repeat that mistake.
Well, I remember seeing all the pictures of you in your swim trunks the day that the press came to watch you swim, which was also an attempt to prove that you were, you know, really healthy and energetic. What was that like for you that day? Was there anything embarrassing about having to, you know, like, strip to your trunks and swim in front of, you know, the national press?
Well, you know, I've competed now for 3 years in my suit, so
right.
I'm used to that. You know, it's funny because my focus at that point was, I'm 51, so you know, I don't have the body I had when I swam in college. And I'm so used to mentally thinking of myself in the photographs of the Dartmouth swimming team that when I would see myself in the photographs that were in the paper, I would lament my aging process. But other than that, the only concern I actually had was how well I would swim. If you remember, the ad we ran in the campaign was an ad of me doing the butterfly, which won an award as the best ad of the campaign. And that, it's interesting because we did that very purposefully. It was a way of not only making the argument about swimming against the tide, which was the kind of theme of the campaign, but by using a stroke like the butterfly, which the vast majority of people cannot do, it was a way of saying to people, look, he can swim the butterfly, you can't, so stop worrying about his health. And so it was a very purposeful attempt to say, you can make your own judgments, just look at him. What was interesting during the campaign was that people would come up to me and say, I saw your butterfly ad, I thought it was wonderful. Who did the swimming?
They thought you had a stunt double?
That's what they thought. It was, and I would tell them, I did it. And they would look at you like, well, okay, I hear you, and I'm supposed to believe you, but I really don't.
Huh. Now, how does an idea like this come up? Not the campaign ad, but the idea of swimming for the national press. How did that come up in the campaign? What was the process of conversation like in deciding whether you should do it or not?
Well, it was never. What happened was that I had intended, no matter the fact that I was running, that I would compete in the nationals. I had competed last year in the YMCA nationals, and this year had signed up for both the Y Nationals and the Masters Nationals, which is the highest level of competition in master swimming. And so I had intended, irrespective of the campaign, to swim in that those competitions. So I would try to schedule during the day, maybe 3 days a week, a workout. So it wasn't that these were staged for the media, but rather they were on my schedule anyway, and I did it constantly. But there was one day when I was finally a serious candidate that all these pools began to fuse together in my mind. But there were 36 cameras when I went to work out between still photographers and the TV cameras. And what's interesting about it is you cannot do a normal workout with that kind of attention, because what you do is you swim faster than you would normally, and you simply get out of your rhythm and you exhaust yourself. So when I was swimming, I realized I was swimming too fast, but I didn't have the courage to slow down because I thought I would look like a very average swimmer when the people turned on the television sets and saw me. So, and I would do a lot more butterfly and a lot less freestyle, and at the end, I would go back into the locker room and say, you fool, but I would do the same thing the next time.
Paul Tsongas, we'll continue our discussion about the presidential campaign process in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Coming up, why it's so difficult to talk about issues in a presidential campaign. We continue our interview with Paul Tsongas. We'll also talk about pollsters, charisma, and surviving cancer. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews Batman Returns, starring Michael Keaton, Michelle Pfeiffer, and Danny DeVito. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Ann Taylor. President Bush has ordered the elimination of federal fees paid by defense industry firms on the sale of arms and commercial products developed from military contracts. NPR's Richard Gonzalez reports.
Mr. Bush typically has used a campaign stop to announce an executive order benefiting the local economy of the city or state he visits. Today he's in California, a state with 54 electoral votes that will be key to his hopes for re-election. But Republican strategists fear that the president could lose California, which is still reeling from the recession. And the defense industry there has been hard hit by budget cutbacks. Today in Orange County, Mr. Bush announced he is directing the Secretary of Defense to eliminate so-called recoupment fees. That's essentially a tax that defense firms have to pay when they sell their military and commercial products to customers other than the government. The move could save defense firms tens of millions of dollars every year. I'm Richard Gonzalez in Washington.
Also in Washington, the U.S. Supreme Court has set limits on the power of local officials to require permits for parades and rallies. The High Court, by a vote of 5-4, said that a law in Forsyth County, Georgia, is in violation of free speech rights. This law was enacted during a time of racial confrontations between civil rights marchers and counter-demonstrators. At issue is the cost of the permit in connection with rallies and parades. Vice President Dan Quayle has attacked the company that put out an album by rap artist Ice-T that critics say encourages violence against police. NPR's Brian Naylor reports.
The vice president continued his campaign of criticizing what he's called the cultural elite with a blast today leveled at the giant media company Time Warner. Speaking in Washington to the American Association of Talk Show Hosts, the vice president said because of the First Amendment guarantee of free speech, the government can't censor Ice-T or his song Cop Killer. But Quayle questioned why, in his words, a company like Time Warner would support the record.
They are making money off a record that is suggesting it's okay to kill cops, and that is wrong.
The chorus to the song includes the words, "Die, pigs, die." The song is about a character who is about to, quote, dust some cops off. Time Warner has previously defended the record, saying it is committed to free expression of ideas and that banning the song will not make violence and rage disappear. This is Brian Naylor in Washington.
In Bosnia, a new outbreak of fighting is hampering efforts to reopen the airport at Sarajevo. UN peacekeepers are trying to open the airport for planes carrying food and medicine. The Bosnian government has signed an agreement to open the Serbian-held airfield by pulling back its heavy artillery. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrials moved up over 11 points to close at 3,285.35 on volume of some 229 million shares. Trading today was heavy. This is NPR News. In Ireland, voters have approved a treaty for a unified Europe by a margin of more than 2-1. Approval was seen as very important to the treaty after voters in Denmark turned it down earlier this month by a very slim margin. According to a government spokesman in Ireland, 69% of those voting yesterday voted in favor of the agreement and 31% opposed it. Under the treaty, Ireland, one of the poorest nations in the European community, is seen as gaining financial benefits. The U.S. Conference of Mayors is meeting in Houston with plans to talk about problems facing the nation's cities. The mayors will play some politics during the meeting. Deborah Frazier of member station KUHF reports from Houston.
At the top of the Conference of Mayors agenda is a 7-point program to improve cities' public safety, job training, and transportation. It requires $34.5 billion from the federal government. Mayors from most of the nation's largest cities are participating, including Chicago, New York, San Diego, Baltimore, and Atlanta. In recent years, the mayors have felt ignored by the Republican administration and believe their concerns haven't been addressed during the presidential primary. But that ends next week when Democratic candidate Bill Clinton and potential independent candidate Ross Perot join the meeting. President Bush has declined his invitation for the second year in a row. Other topics up for discussion include homelessness, AIDS, small business, emergency medical services, unemployment, and the arts. For National Public Radio, I'm Deborah Frazier in Houston.
Russian President Boris Yeltsin has told Canada's parliament that his country has chosen a state of law and wants to cooperate in trade and international security. In his comments and in meeting with government officials, Yeltsin said again today that Russia needs help and money to help it move toward a free market economy. He said that while Canada may not be able to invest a lot of money, there are many projects for cooperation on both sides. This is NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. We're continuing our interview about the presidential campaign process with Paul Tsongas, who ran in the Democratic primaries until suspending his campaign in March. Tsongas is a former senator from Massachusetts. His 1984 book about getting cancer and leaving the Senate, Heading Home, has just been published in a new edition with a new introduction. During the primary, Tsongas' major issue was the economy, one of the most complex issues to get across. I asked him about the obstacles he faced in addressing the economy during his campaign.
Well, I think the obstacles were really no different than perhaps you find in any democratic society. I gave a speech the other day to a journalism class, and I said, I went over and picked up a newspaper, and I said, put yourself in this situation. The headline of the story on the front page is, Tsongas articulates position on world population link to economic development. Turn see page 15. I said, how many of you would really be interested in turning to page 15? Then I said, imagine a second story. Tsongas regrets having had harem in the 1980s. Turn to page 15. Well, I mean, it's obvious. And the question is, how do you break through that in a situation? What we ended up relying upon, surprisingly, was my book. That the demand for the book was so extraordinary, and that's where a lot of our volunteers came from, that people were ready to absorb 83 pages of our policy. But the problem was getting that through the mass media. And that's why I think the use of the Larry Kings, the use of talk programs, et cetera, is really very valuable, because it, rather than a 9-second, which is now the average soundbite on the nightly news, you have a capacity to articulate things in some depth. And I will tell you that one of the great changes in American politics is C-SPAN. I would invariably run into people who would come up to me and know my issues in some detail and who were supporters who had become, in essence, C-SPAN junkies, not unlike what your network does in trying to do things in some depth. And that's, I think, where people end up having a sense of the issues.
One of the things you were up against with the press in your campaign was that people referred to you as the anti-charisma candidate. And, I mean, in a Newsweek voter's guide, it described you as having a dweebish TV presence, and it said this would make it hard to rally the country with speeches. Reading all this charisma stuff reminded me of the comic Washington, the Mark Allen Stamety comic strip about Washington, where his Senator Bob Forehead has a charismatician who's, I mean, this is the most shallow candidate in the world, you know, and the job of the charismatician, of course, is to just kind of give him lots of charisma. How important do you think charisma should be in a voter's decision to elect somebody?
Well, I don't think it can be dismissed. There is charisma and there is charisma. I think ideas have real power, and no one ever accused me. I used to say that when I would introduce my wife, that I did not have charisma, but I had enough sense to marry it. And she was someone who could really, on a television set, just project. And I don't know where you get it, and if I could go and buy it, I would. But the fact is that Nikki was able to do that. I've never been able to do that, so I have to rely upon the soundness of my ideas and people's perceiving my commitment to these ideas. So I think you can lead people. I mean, look at Ross Perot. I find it intriguing watching Ross Perot. They used to accuse me of being too short. I think I'm 3 inches taller than he is, that I was non-charismatic in terms of my telegenic qualities. Well, if I was non-charismatic, I don't know what you say about him, but he has the charisma based on people's perception that this guy will go in there and do what's necessary. So it may not be the kind of Robert Redford in The Candidate kind of charisma, but I think ideas do have power, particularly at a time when people are scared stiff about where their country is going. And there's no doubt in my mind that that is what Ross Perot is tied into.
What kind of critique sessions would you do of yourself on television so that you could, you know, project better? Was that a regular part of the campaigning process?
Well, it wasn't in the beginning. I was pretty stubborn about things and said, look, I'm into this. Seems absurd in the retelling. I'm into this campaign because of issues. I'm not going to be handled, that kind of thing. And then one day, excuse me, my wife made the point that she said, look, Paul, you're really being a fool here. The fact is we got into this race to get these ideas articulated, and all the press is talking about is your lack of telegenic capabilities. So why don't you acknowledge that and overcome it so people will listen to what you're talking about? And we reached out to a woman, Joyce Tsongas, who was married previously to my cousin in Portland, Oregon, and she came and we began that process. And I must say, I regret having been so mulish in the beginning, because by the time she had worked with us and I did the later TV debates, we did quite well.
One more question about Perot. Do you think that it's a good thing for the electoral process in America to have an independent probable candidate who is showing so strongly?
I think it's very healthy. I think both major parties need a severe kick in the pants. And the fact is that the Republican Party is inert. There is no vision there. There's no sense of where do we go from here. And to send Dan Quayle out in the Murphy Brown crusade with the cultural elite speaks to the bankruptcy of a lack of vision. I suppose I'm a Democrat, and that's to be expected from me. But I almost feel as strongly about my own party. The fact is that the sense of economic threat is something my party simply does not perceive and can address. So I think that Ross Perot, in that respect, is very healthy. You're not going to solve this problem by a third party. You're not going to substitute for the two major parties, even if you were to elect Ross Perot for 4 years. Ultimately, one of these two parties is going to have to understand what's it. Basically, they're going to have to take their pollsters, take them out and shoot them, and understand principles, and that party will dominate for decades. But I think to watch the Democrats and Republicans squirm because of Ross Perot, I think is exceedingly healthy, because I know what happens in those councils. I've served, I've been in those meetings. You start off a session in both parties with the pollster coming in explaining where the American people are, what they want, and you then try to figure out how you pander to that. And I think that is atrocious. And so my attitude is Ross Perot was doing both parties a favor because they would be incremental at best absent this kind of threat.
How did you use pollsters during your campaign?
Well, we couldn't afford them. And the advantage I had was that I had written a book, A Call to Economic Arms, before I announced. So I was locked into these positions. So it wasn't a matter of let's do a poll to figure out what we stand for. We used polls after we got some money to basically figure out where we were vis-a-vis the other candidates. But one thing we did not do, to our credit, and I don't mean just myself, but the people around me, is that we never took positions based on polling data.
Paul Tsongas is my guest. We're going to take a short break, then talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Paul Tsongas is my guest. What's the first thing you would change about the campaign process if you had the power to change it?
It's interesting. I get that question all the time. And people, I think, presume that since I lost, that I would feel very strongly that the system is wrong, that the definition of a system is when you can win. But I must say, I really would not change it. I think there have been some major changes in terms of the most important reform was matching funds. The federal government matching contributions up to $250. That is what kept us alive. And I think if nothing else, that is going to give people who are outsiders, who are ideas people, who are not taking PAC money, the opportunity to compete. The only change that I really call for is with the press, that when somebody like me comes along in the future who holds no office, who is not taking PAC money, who has very limited capacity to raise money, don't write us off. Give us the same chance you give someone who holds office. If I had not gotten sick, been elected to the Senate reelected in 1984, and then reelected in 1990, and run for president, I would not have been treated the way I had been. So the presumption was that having gone through the battle with cancer, having been in the private sector, made me a lesser person, a lesser qualified, if you will, to be president than if I had stayed in Washington and served in the Senate. That is absurd. So my comment to the press was, if people come along, give them a chance and let them disprove their capabilities, don't presume them.
You were the first presidential candidate to have had cancer. Health was an issue, but you seemed to really be able to more or less put that behind you. But after you dropped out of the race, it was revealed that you had a node with cancerous cells as late as 1987, which was a year after your experimental treatment. And some doctors said that that was actually very significant because it showed the bone marrow transplant that you had didn't cure you. And that raised the question, why wasn't this information brought up sooner?
Well, what happened was that information was no secret. When it happened, the reporters here in Boston at the Boston Globe were aware of it. And at the time, it didn't mean a heck of a lot to us because over time, there was no indication of cancer, number one. Secondly, there was an article in the Boston Magazine that specifically talked about the node and the fact that it was cancerous. So this was an open issue. During the campaign, I told a reporter from the Washington Post about the node. What had happened was that I've been through so many experiences after the bone marrow transplant with things that are frightening and potentially serious. When you do a CAT scan, things show up and you do them 3 days later, they're not there again, those kinds of things. So the node was viewed as a happenstance, and my doctor told me 3 or 4 years ago, we're not sure what it means. So in the process of trying to deal with survival, you simply don't focus on these things and let them dominate your thinking. Now, what had happened was I had mentioned that to a couple of reporters, but the doctors did not mention it to the New York Times reporter when he did the feature story on my health, and they should have. But it wasn't viewed by them to be that significant, and the fact is if we were trying to keep it secret, the last thing I would have done was to tell the Washington Post about the node. But I think the press legitimately felt that, however we may have felt about the node, that my doctors, et cetera, that should have been referred to more prominently than it was. So in retrospect, I think it's clear that a mistake was made, and to be able to say, well, we told other reporters, really doesn't give the New York Times reporter any comfort.
How public do you think a candidate's medical record should be?
Well, I think normally they should be private, but in the case of someone like me who's had cancer, I think they have the right to access. I don't like it. And what I've done is I've asked Dana-Farber, and they did it on their own, to duplicate all of my records and to seal them and send them to me. So I now have that, and I said if I ever were to surface again on the national political scene, those records would be available to the press and to other physicians and let them decide what they wish to decide. I mean, that's a heck of a precedent to set, and I do it with great reluctance, but I think in my case, I have no choice.
The experimental treatment that you went through for cancer was, I know, very painful. It was not painful. Well, no, here's what I'm thinking of. When you had to get your bone drilled to see if the treatment was appropriate, you had to get your bone drilled and marrow taken out to see if the cancer had spread. And that sounded like a really, really miserable process. The anesthetic does not apparently affect the bone pain. How did you deal with the pain?
Well, the first couple of times I went through that, I spent my time commiserating with myself and feeling sorry for myself. And it's about 20 minutes, a half an hour, and it's very painful. But one day I figured out while I was lying there that, you know, there are a lot of people, thousands of people, have been tortured. And the fact is they don't undergo 20 minutes of pain. They undergo hours of pain. The people who are inflicting it upon them are not friends who really care for you and physicians, but they are tormentors, and they don't get out. You're going to, a half an hour from now, you're going to be out. You're going to get back in your car and drive home to a family that cares for you. So what the hell are you complaining about? And once you look at it in that perspective, it seems very endurable.
Mm-hmm. Paul Tsongas is my guest. What do you do to make a living out of politics?
Well, actually, I make quite a good living. I'm back with my law firm. I'll be giving speeches. I serve on these corporate boards, so financially, we'll do fine. By the fall, we'll be back to where we were, kind of sea level before the campaign. But money will not be a problem of our lives.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
Very good. I enjoyed it.
Paul Tsongas. There's a new edition of his 1984 book, Heading Home, about getting cancer and leaving the Senate. It's published by Vintage. This is Fresh Air. Let's see what's coming up on All Things Considered. Robert Siegel's with us. Hi, Robert.
Hello, Terry. We'll be hearing about two Supreme Court rulings today, one on freedom of speech and political demonstrations, and another on nuclear waste and whether states must be obliged to take title to the radioactive waste within their boundaries. Also, we'll be hearing from Neil Conan today with a special report on what U.S. policy was toward Iraq in the months prior to Operation Desert Storm. And we'll be talking with a sociologist from UCLA who wrote The Seductions of Crime about the seductions of rioting and why it is that the protests in Los Angeles and the celebrations over the Bulls' victory in Chicago led to so much similar behavior.
Thanks, Robert. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Tim Burton's 1989 movie version of Batman turned out to be the sixth biggest hit in movie history. Now Burton has made a sequel without Jack Nicholson's Joker, but with Danny DeVito playing the Penguin and Michelle Pfeiffer playing Catwoman. Film critic Stephen Schiff took a look at Batman Returns.
This is a terrific entertainment. Buoyant and witty, action-packed, sexy, beautifully directed. You'll even hear it's better than its predecessor, but there I have to disagree. For me, Tim Burton's first Batman movie got about as close as Hollywood could ever come to the brooding power of Wagnerian opera. It was dark, sure, but that was because it was about the big, dark, metaphysical issues. Its two antagonists, Batman and the Joker, had both narrowly escaped death, and that had made them feel like outcasts forever. Deep inside their antagonism, they knew they were in some ways brothers. The main characters in Batman Returns are also people who barely escape death, but the movie doesn't really care about that. Batman Returns is about the search for identity, and because none of the characters has one, not a clear one anyway, there's something blurry and muffled about it all. Danny DeVito's Penguin, for instance, was abandoned at birth because of his peculiar deformities. Now he's grown up into something resembling a giant white mango, with flippers for hands, a beaky nose, and a voice that sounds like Jimmy Durante in a terrible mood. But what does he want? Hard to say. To find his parents? Earn the love of Gotham City? Be elected mayor? Destroy his enemies? The movie at various times goes for all of these options. And that keeps Penguin's villainy from ever coming into focus. Besides, Burton and his screenwriters have provided a giant distraction. Selina Kyle, played by Michelle Pfeiffer, is the frumpy secretary to Christopher Walken's evil tycoon Max Schreck. She knows too much about Shrek's nefarious schemes, so much, in fact, that Shrek feels compelled to push her out the umpteenth story of his skyscraper. Miraculously, she lives, and in a sequence that makes absolutely no sense but is compulsively watchable anyway, she turns into slinky, snarly Catwoman. And what is Catwoman after? Who knows? Sometimes she seems to want revenge on Shrek, sometimes she wants to save Gotham City, sometimes she wants to get rid of Batman so she can be the only superhero in town. Whatever her motives, it isn't long before she arranges a meeting with the Penguin himself.
We need to talk. You see, you and I have something in common.
Sounds familiar. Appetite for destruction? Contempt for the czars of fashion? Wait, don't tell me. Naked, sexual charisma.
Batman. The thorn in both our sides. The fly in our ointment.
Ointment? Scented or unscented?
I'll come back later.
Perchance are you a registered voter? I am a mayoral prospect, you know.
I have but one pet cause today. Ban the Bat.
As Batman, Michael Keaton spends most of the movie puckering his famous pucker and staring darkly into the Batcave's video screens. I missed the feeling of titanic inner struggle that he brought to the first Batman. But the movie's plot, such as it is, centers on the wicked mating dance that he and Catwoman perform. Two masked characters, ordinary by day, animal by night, nuts for each other. It's a juicy premise, and Burton and his actors squeeze every drop out of it, especially Pfeiffer, who makes Catwoman at once formidable and erotic and poignantly vulnerable. You could almost say she steals the film, only she doesn't quite. Beau Welch does. Who's he? He's the designer of the towering fascist deco sets that make the movie's real main character, Gotham City, come to life. In Batman Returns, Gotham City is the American urban jungle writ large. And as Penguin milks the media to get himself elected mayor, you can't help thinking of Ross Perot, a creature out of nowhere promising vague salvation in a world that's coming apart at the seams. Batman Returns always seems to be coming apart too, but no matter. Burton's vision may be out of control, but nothing else on the screen this summer feels so intensely alive.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for Vanity Fair. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Naomi Person, Amy Sallet, and Phyllis Myers, with associate producer Joan Tuohy and Sue Spolin. Research assistance from Ellen Silva. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Former Defense Secretary Caspar Weinberger has been indicted for lying to Congress about the Iran-Contra affair. On the next Fresh Air, we talk about what this means for the ongoing investigation with Tom Blanton. Blanton filed the Freedom of Information Act request and lawsuit that forced the U.S. government to release Oliver North's diaries. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.